Hello, I'm Jonathan Dimbleby. Thanks for taking the time to download this edition of Any Questions from BBC Radio 4. Welcome to the first Any Questions of the year. We are in the London Borough of Kensington at Heathrop College, which is part of the University of London and specialises in philosophy and theology. The college was founded in Belgium 400 years ago by the Jesuits because it was too dangerous to be a Roman Catholic in England. Later, it went to France, but had to leave once again during the French Revolution when it was dangerous not only to be a priest, but to be English as well. So it came to Britain, where it was safe, and the college is now here. Today it has 800 students, and its mission is to offer them, whatever career they may pursue afterwards, an education, I quote, marked by intelligence, scholarship, and generosity of spirit. On our panel, Chris Grayling once worked for the BBC and for Channel 4. He's been in the Commons since 2001 and in 2012 was promoted to become Secretary of State for Justice. Sadiq Khan is the son of immigrant parents who came from Pakistan. His father was a bus driver. He became a human rights lawyer before entering the Commons in 2005 and he is now Shadow Justice Secretary. Sarah Tether was first elected to Parliament in 2003 when she became the youngest MP in the House. She's always been on the liberal wing of the Liberal Democrats. She served as Children's Minister in the Coalition Government until she was sacked in September 2012. She's since said she will stand down in 2015, in part at least because Nick Clegg's stance on immigration left her feeling, I quote, catastrophically depressed and utterly desolate. Patrick O'Flynn is the chief political commentator at the Daily Express. This week, Nigel Farage, though, appointed him Director of Communications for UKIP. He's also standing for the party in the Euro elections in what is widely regarded as one of, if not its most, winnable seat. Our panel. And our first question, please.
Helen Gardner. Can the public trust the police?
Keith Wallace, PC Keith Wallace, has admitted lying about seeing Andrew Mitchell at that so-called Plebgate altercation in Downing Street. Secretary of State for Justice.
Absolutely, yes. In communities up and down this country, there are hard-working officers, often working in very difficult situations, doing the right thing on behalf of all of us. If you have any group of 130,000 people, you will find things that sometimes go wrong. And today's case is shocking. What happened to Andrew Mitchell is shocking. The activities of this particular officer have undoubtedly damaged confidence in the police, but people should not lose confidence in the police. All of my experience in my own constituency and elsewhere is there are officers work immensely hard in difficult circumstances to do the right thing for us, and we should thank them for it.
Should Andrew Mitchell be restored, as many of his friends would like to see, to the Cabinet to demonstrate that he can continue in a proper, serious, major role?
I very much hope Andrew will return to a senior position before too long, yes. I think what happened was wrong. Clearly he was traduced by the circumstances we've heard in the case today. I'm a strong supporter of Andrew making a return to a senior role in politics.
And one more question on this. The Metropolitan Commissioner, Bernard Hogan Howe, has apologised and says he will meet with Mr Mitchell to apologise to him, but he did say in November of 2012, I'm 100% behind the officers involved in that. They did the right thing. They accurately reported, in my view, what happened. They have no reason to lie. I believe my officers. One senior Tory says he ought to consider or reconsider his position.
Well, I don't think that. I mean, I think the Commissioner is a fine police officer. He stands by his team and stood by his team, but was also ready and willing to accept that things weren't right and has come out and apologised for it. Surely that's what you'd expect of the Met Commissioner.
Sadiq Khan.
Well, the question is, can the public trust the police? They should be able to trust the police, but a significant number now of the public don't trust the police, and for the reasons Chris has said, that's a shame, because we police by consent. The police can only do their job if the public have confidence in the police, come forward to report crime, come forward to give intelligence, come forward to give evidence, and come forward and join the police service. But the Andrew Mitchell affair, what happened with Ian Tomlinson, what we've discovered about Hillsborough, what we know about the IPCC briefing after the Mark Duggan case, a considerable number of our fellow citizens don't trust the police, and that's why the police need to take steps to try and win back the trust and confidence of those sections of our community. And I'll give you one example of a section of our fellow Londoners who, over the last 30 years, have some reason to be suspicious of the police and mistrustful. And that's the Black Asian minority ethnic part of our communities. Over the last 30 years, a disproportionate number of them are stopped and searched. 28 times as many young Black Londoners are stopped and searched against their white neighbours. More than 90% of those who are stopped and searched aren't then arrested. And their attitude towards the police is clouded by that. So what I want to see, of course, for all of us, to be able to trust the police, that police, if they're going to do their job properly, you need to make sure they win back the trust confidence of those people who, for reasons that I've explained, lack that trust and confidence in the police.
Just on the first point of Andrew Mitchell, I quoted the Metropolitan Commissioner, also the leader of the Labour Party, your leader in the House, joined the kicking of Andrew Mitchell and said his position is untenable. They say I practice class war and they go around calling people plebs. In other words, he's toast. Should Ed Miliband consider being gracious enough to apologise?
Well, I think due process should follow its course. And Andrew Mitchell, the officers apologised to Andrew Mitchell, and Andrew Mitchell didn't use the words he did. And anybody who has accused him of using those words, which he clearly
did Ed Miliband jump into the battle before he should have done?
Well, I mean, it wasn't Ed Miliband who accepted his resignation. It was David Cameron who asked him to resign.
And, so he shouldn't apologise. And Andrew Mitchell should. No need for him to say, I'm terribly sorry, Andrew. I really regret I said that.
Oh, no, look. If Andrew Mitchell is accused of saying words he didn't, those who said those things should reflect on that.
Sarah Tether.
I think it's not been a very good week for the police. I mean, obviously, Andrew Mitchell's case has been leading on the news this evening, but, of course, the Mark Duggan verdicts left very, very many questions for the police still to answer, although they may have, the jury might have cleared them of the most serious charge of unlawful killing. There were an awful lot of things that were left hanging in the balance. And on this, I have much sympathy, actually, with what Sadiq was saying about the real need for the police to work very hard to try and rebuild trust. And I think on the ground, certainly if I think about my own constituency, the police are working extremely hard. And I think they are very aware of particularly the long and bitter history that happens with many communities who feel, frankly, that they have been over-policed as criminals and under-policed as victims, as if the police are always there when they're not needed and never there when they really are needed. And many of those kind of issues, I mean, I'm pleased to see the government taking some action on stop and search, for example. I think that's a start. But there are much wider issues that both the Mark Duggan case and Andrew Mitchell case raise here, and that's about the culture of openness and transparency and our ability to hold the police to account when things go wrong. And that's going to take an awful lot more than a few actions on stop and search.
Can the public trust the police, Patrick O'Flynn?
Yes, they can. I think it's unfortunate if we're conflating the Andrew Mitchell case, which was relatively trivial, with the Mark Duggan case. And we basically know two things in the Andrew Mitchell case. One is that at least one police officer behaved utterly disgracefully. But we also know from Andrew Mitchell himself that he was quite rude to the police officers at Downing Street who keep government ministers and senior civil servants safe. And I, in my job as a political journalist, have often gone in and out of Downing Street. All I can say is I've always been very polite to the police, and they've always been very helpful to me. Now, on the Mark Duggan case, I think I'm sort of sitting in a bit of a parallel universe from some of the other panellists. And one of the reasons I'm moving into elected politics with UKIP is to put new choices on the ballot paper for the electorate. And a fundamental choice I really didn't think I'd have to be putting on was that the police should be on the side of the law-abiding public and not allow organised criminals to set the law and order agenda. And I think that's what's happened in the wake of the Mark Duggan inquest.
Who set the law and order agenda? Which criminals have set the law and order agenda?
The associates of Mark Duggan, who is undoubtedly a very serious gang member,
You're not saying those people who spoke are criminals, are you?
I'm saying there were a very large number of people associated with Mark Duggan at the result of the inquest. They behaved utterly disgracefully, many of them, intimidated jurors who'd just done their public service. And then it dismays me to a certain extent that elected representatives, some London MPs, and even some senior people in the police appear to be bending over backwards, allowing those people to set a law and order agenda that I bet the majority of law-abiding people in Tottenham and elsewhere in London do not support at all. And the people I talk to in London are sick of gangsters and violent crime. And even to the point people talk about stop and search being a bad thing. I know many parents of teenagers, I'm a parent of teenagers myself, who welcome stop and search, because one thing that never gets measured is the deterrent effect of stop and search to limit the number of weapons that get taken out on the streets.
How many times have your teenage children been stopped and searched?
My teenage children are a bit too young to be out and stopped and searched. But I have spoken... I've spoken to inner-city parents who are glad of stop and search, because by far the most deaths caused among young inner-city teenagers and youths are not caused by the police at all. They're caused by other inner-city youths carrying guns and knives.
Patrick,
I think the police should police without fear of these pressure groups.
How do you explain that more than 90%... of those young black men who were stopped and searched are not then arrested, let alone charged, prosecuted and found guilty? And what is their impression of the police service, who rely upon them coming forward to report crime, on them coming forward to provide intelligence, and on them coming forward to be witnesses, and them joining the police service tomorrow if today they're being treated this way?
I mean, particularly on gun crime, the relationship between the police and communities really matters, because that's the only way in which you're going to get information.
Let me bring in the Secretary of State. It was touched on earlier. The Home Secretary said we've got to get stop and search right. I think I quote her accurately. Does that mean that in order to regain trust, it is your view, clearly if that is the case, contrary to what Patrick O'Flynn has said, that there is something that has to be done to meet the problem that Sadiq Khan has identified?
Well, I think there is a case for stop and search to be used when there is good reason to suspect that it's needed. What is not acceptable is stop and search simply being used for its own sake.
And is it being overused?
I think Theresa May is working on... Well, Theresa May's view is that it's been used too much, and she is currently consulting on changing that. So I think that's the right thing to do.
Can I welcome that? I think Theresa May and Yvette Cooper are doing a really good job trying to change our attitude towards what is a very important tool in the armed kit of the police.
I'm going to ask our audience to by a show of hands, the question put, can the public trust the police? What is your view? Can you trust the police? Hands up if you would. Do you not trust the police, or should you have doubts? Hands up. Well, it's pretty even, but there's a small majority, I think, that says that you should have doubt or not trust, but a small, very small majority. It's very nearly 50-50. You may have thoughts about that. If so, any answers will assuredly be for you. You can phone Julian Warwicker on 03 700 100 444. That's after the Saturday broadcast of this programme, and you can email any.answers@bbc.co.uk. And do tweet using the hashtag BBCAQ. We'll go to our next.
James Denslow, if you were London Mayor, would you consider using water cannons, and in what circumstances?
Boris Johnson has written to the Home Secretary saying that he's broadly convinced that there is a role for water cannon. Sadiq Khan, if you were London Mayor, would you consider using water cannons?
Well, I'm really proud that as somebody who's born in this city and lived here all my life, not only have we never used water cannons, but we haven't got water cannons to use. I think the Mayor of London should spend more time trying to run this fantastic city, getting our transport system working properly, addressing the housing crisis there is, trying to work with employers to get jobs for young people, than trying to be the leader of the Tory party.
That sounds a bit like someone considering being a candidate for the role. Are you? Do you want to be mayor?
The only job I want is Chris's.
So you will not accept, even if you were offered the job of mayor?
No, I want Chris's job, not Boris's.
I didn't think you'd answer the question. Would you?
Well, it's very, very interesting saying, because slightly mischievously, as you might expect, I follow Sadiq on Twitter, and it's quite noticeable on the justice front that there's about 10 times as many tweets about Labour politics in London as there are about justice matters. I have a sneaking suspicion that Sadiq may just harbour an ambition to have a go for the mayoral job.
Let's leave that. Let me put to you, as you jumped in there, would you consider using water cannons? Is it a sensible thing for the Mayor of London to consider?
I think we should always consider sensible options. I mean, I do not know. I've not studied in detail the use elsewhere and the impact of water cannon. I am not intrinsically opposed to the idea. I certainly think we should use sensible measures that allow us, in difficult circumstances, where you have a riot or a major disturbance, to calm it down without risk to life and limb. Water cannon can do that, so it's not something I would rule out, but nor is it something I've studied closely enough to say it's absolutely the right thing to do.
You didn't quite answer that question, actually. Would you rule it out, whether you're mayor or not, would you rule out water cannon or not, Sadiq Khan?
I would.
I think if you look at the use of water cannons, where they use big, wide boulevards, they've caused actually serious injury, Chris, including very, very serious harm to people. And I think actually more time should be spent dealing with preventing people rioting, causing mischief and mayhem rather than the effects. And the huge sums of money, there's a very good reason why Theresa May is not signing the cheque for this, because she disagrees with you and agrees with me that this is a huge, colossal waste of money. But also, we should have a situation where the Metropolitan Police Commissioner is looking for the use of water cannons rather than de-escalating potential trouble.
Patrick O'Flynn.
Would you consider it? Well, so far as I know, no senior Metropolitan Police officer has requested investment in water cannons. Like some of the other panel members, I think those very key operational decisions about what resources might be useful in what circumstances to keep law and order are best off being taken by expert and senior police officers. Personally, I don't know enough about the impact of water cannon in London's fairly narrow streets. It could do more harm than it solves. But I wouldn't personally rule it out. But what I will say, when Boris Johnson's name is attached to an eye-catching claim like this, is I'm afraid I often think it's just a gimmick. It's just a sort of something to say, which he thinks will make an easy headline. And I don't particularly think that does him much credit as London's senior elected representative.
Boris, any answers is available to you as to everyone else. 03 700 100 444 on that. Sarah Tether.
I don't want to see water cannon being used on the streets of Brent, frankly. And it seems to me that it was absolutely right that Theresa May has sent him packing and told him that the government won't pay for it. I think, especially considering the difficulties that the police have had in policing many of the demonstrations that we've had in London over the last few years, I don't want to see them being given more powers that may be harmful to individuals. I would rather they focused on trying to contain violence and de-escalate it.
James Denslow, you raised the question. Would you consider it?
No, I think it's a terrible idea, and I do worry that if the Home Secretary is not going to fund it, Boris will probably look for private sponsorship and we'll probably have Thames Water sponsoring it.
We go to our next.
Martin Scott, should migrants be banned from benefits for 5 years?
This is in the debate between the parties about how long benefits should be denied to migrants, starting at 3 months, as the coalition government, up to 5 years, which is UKIP's position. I'll come to you in a moment, Patrick O'Flynn. Sarah Tether, in principle, what do you think about this?
No, I don't think they should. And I think at the moment we're in a rather unholy arms race between the parties to demonstrate who can be toughest on migrants. And it's more of a virility symbol than dealing with any kind of real problem. We're basically inventing problems so that we can try and demonstrate that we're in touch with public opinion. And then when we've invented the problem, we try and find a solution that will fix it. And over a period of time, the public just get more and more cynical because they know that it's all guff. And then we get more desperate, so we invent another problem and another solution which won't fix it. And we go round and round in circles. And in my view, it's a form of democratic self-harm, and it's not very sensible.
Is your own position that, given that you're saying there's a sort of arms race, that you wouldn't have any constraint on rights to welfare benefits on those who are immigrants into this country? And in the context, would you have controls on immigration in numbers or not?
Well, I mean, we already have controls on people's ability to access the benefit system. And the problem is most of the people who come here are coming here to work. So, you know, and the danger is when you start setting up different systems to try and prevent people from claiming benefits, if you're not careful, the people you actually affect are people who've gone abroad, British citizens who've gone abroad and been away for a while and then come back again. And, I mean, what good is that? You know, and what happens when we end up with tit-for-tat with other countries? This has got nothing to do with the good of the country and everything to do with the good of polling and headlines. And that's not in the interest of democracy. It's not in the interest of Britain.
Patrick O'Flynn, as I said, it's the policy of UKIP. 5 years.
Yes.
Should migrants be banned from 5 years?
Yes, they should. And let me begin by saying something as a UKIP representative, that if we got our immigration system right and had a comprehensive point system which could really be quite rigorous and see if people had the skills and aptitudes to come here and put in more than they took out, then immigration could be a fantastic boon for this country. And London in particular has a huge pull for migrants, and we could have some of the most, as we do, some of the most talented and brightest people in the world. But it really makes no sense when we have a public sector deficit of £100 billion to be bringing in people into the country who will be dependent on welfare. And Sarah said something about people who come to work, and I'm afraid the way the tax and benefits system has been set up, even someone coming in to do low-paid work now will only pay a fairly minimal direct tax contribution, fairly minimal national insurance. And if they come in with children of school age, that's £5,000 a pop for a school place. And if they're on a low income, it'll be another £500 or £600 for the pupil premium and child benefit.
Is working on minimum wage. I mean, what about all the French people who are working in the city?
No. The whole point, the whole point about EU immigration is we're not allowed to differentiate at all. It's completely open door. And I'm saying that is ridiculous for a country in our situation with our youth unemployment, our high housing shortage, our public sector deficit. It's certainly true there are German and French bankers or whatever who come in who make a net contribution.
Retire in the south of France, because that's what it's going to mean when you start introducing those type of controls.
This stuff worked all right when the EU was mainly countries of roughly similar standards of living. But when you open the door completely to all these very poor countries in Eastern Europe, it is simply not sustainable. And I said earlier I came in to elected politics to offer a new choice on the ballot paper with UKIP, and that choice is to leave the EU and take control of our immigration system so it can work in the national interest.
And in this case, just to follow up on that, taking control in the national interest could mean that the country is poorer, according to Nigel Farage, and he says he'd welcome it, than it would be if there weren't those controls implemented. So can you tell me how much poorer you're willing for the country to be in order to satisfy the needs of the
licenses? Andrew Green of Migration Watch, whose predictions on this have been much better than the government and indeed the BBC, has calculated that the average EU migrant over the last decade or so has contributed about 66 pence a week net. But I'm not talking about stopping EU immigration. I'm talking about applying a point system so we can make the net positive impact of that much bigger. So the net big contributors can be allowed in, and the people who are coming in with low skills and large numbers of dependents can't be allowed in. So I'm pushing a system that would actually lead to a great upsurge in economic benefit compared to the system we have at the moment.
Sorry, Nigel Farage on Today, your boss now, said, if you said to me, would you want to see over the next 10 years a further 5 million people come into Britain, and if that happened, we'd all be slightly richer, I would say, actually, do you know what? I'd rather we weren't slightly richer. So, yes, he goes with the thing that he preferred to be somewhat poorer. So, basic question that the taxpayer and the voter would like to know, I suspect, is how much poorer are you willing for Britain to be in order to meet what you regard as the social obligations of reducing the numbers of immigrants?
Well, listen, if you put it in that binary way, I'll say to you, I think David Cameron...
Which is the way he put it.
David Cameron used to call this general well-being. There are non-pecuniary factors in standards of living. And if your community... solidarity is shot to pieces, community cohesion reduced, housing crisis stoked up, then that may leave you with a lower standard of living. That's why people are so sceptical about the immigration system at the moment.
Very briefly, Sarah Tedden, I want to bring in Sadiq Khan.
I think the thing is, we wouldn't end up just being poorer financially. I think we'd be poorer on a whole host of other reasons as well. One of the reasons I like living in London is it is such a diverse place. I like to be able to count amongst my friends, amongst my social group, people from Italy, people from Spain, people from Peru, people from Nigeria, from Pakistan, from India. That's what I like about living in London,
and
I'm proud
of it. It's numbers we're talking about, the vast uncontrolled scale, which is impacting people who aren't middle-class professionals like us in a very tough way.
Okay, I'm going to bring in Sadiq Khan.
Jonathan, 20 or so minutes ago, you told us that this college was founded in Belgium and then moved to France before coming here. And the ethos is intelligence and generosity of spirit. And Patrick, I wish you showed either of those two things.
Well, sometimes...
thing. Immigration, I say, as the son of a bus driver. The son of a bus driver who came here and worked all his life, working age, driving buses in this country, paying taxes and national insurance, is that immigration has brought huge benefit to this country, economic, social and cultural. Just walking around this great city, whether you want to have a bagel or a curry, or whether you have to visit the NHS or support one of our London teams, the benefit migration has brought has been huge. But where Patrick has a point, if you could express it properly, is that for those who are low-skilled and those who are sometimes least well-off, the impact has been disproportionate to them. Because as Patrick was about to say, I think, when he was accusing me of being middle-class, was for some of us, the benefits have been more than others. And so we do need to address the fact that there are some people who are employing immigrants below the minimum wage. We need to regulate the national minimum wage and prosecute them. It is a fact that recruitment agents have policies where they only recruit immigrants and not British workers. We need to address that. And they then have tied housing and can pay lower wages. We need to address that. We need to make sure our employers pay more, pay a living wage, and that will improve the quality of life, not just of British citizens, but also those who come here to work as well, Patrick.
Well, can I just
come back? I must move on. Come back swiftly on the principal charge, on the intelligence and generosity charge.
Well, yes, indeed. And obviously, Sadiq has the majority view in this audience in Kensington, London's most prosperous borough, on his side. But I can tell you, I can tell you that every public opinion poll shows that most of the British population are more on my side. And on the point of generosity, it worries me when left-wing politicians start talking about generosity, because normally they're expert at being generous with other people's money.
I just before I bring in the Secretary of State, I just want to pick up something that Chuka Amuna said on Question Time about this. And he sounded somewhat, it seems to some people, like Patrick O'Flynn, saying that the founders of the European movement had in mind a free movement of workers, not free movement of job seekers. We've got to work with our European partners to deal with that.
One of the things, Jonathan, we are keen to do is reform the way the EU works. That includes looking at the transitional arrangements when it comes to new countries joining the EU, how long those transitional arrangements apply for. One of the other issues is when those from not from the UK come here, their children are back in countries of origin, but they can claim child benefit. Those are areas which we're going to work with our European partners to reform.
Okay. Chris Grayling.
Well, of course, the great irony is that it was the Labour Party in government in 2005 that didn't have transitional arrangements this country, which meant that we were one of the only two countries in Europe that accepted migrants from Eastern Europe, and that is why we had such a big wave of migration in the middle of the last decade. So it's somewhat ironic to hear the opposite argument today. I think I spent 2.5 years as Employment Minister arguing for changes to the benefit rules across Europe. The current situation is completely untenable. A couple of examples. At the moment, we have European court rulings that, on the one hand, say we have to provide benefits to people who come from other European countries to live in the UK. On the other hand, the same court will say we have to provide benefits to UK citizens who go and live in other European countries. Both of those cannot be right. And the situation where we have to pay child benefit to a child who has never entered the UK is, in my view, utterly unacceptable.
Well, on this point, as the question is put, ban for benefits in 5 years, those of your supporters of your party who may be inclining, as the polls suggest, towards UKIP and may therefore find rather attractive the thought that benefits for 5 years would be tougher, what's wrong with stopping benefits for longer than the 3 months which you are advocating?
Well, I mean, I would argue, you know, what we're doing in the 3 months is doing what we can do within the current laws. David Cameron's been very clear in saying renegotiating our membership of the European Union will have to address this point. My view is that, well, if what comes out of that renegotiation is not acceptable to the people of this country, they will have the opportunity to vote to leave. But they'll only have the opportunity of that referendum if they vote Conservative, because as we've seen in the House of Lords today, the other parties, Labour and Liberal Democrats, are arguing against an in-out referendum for this country. My view is that referendum is necessary, and as far as I can see, the vast majority of people in this country want that referendum.
Which takes, you won't, because you don't know what the questions are that are coming to you, you won't know that you've queued up very well, as it were, the next question, please.
Paul Fonseca. 24 hours may be a long time in politics, but if there were to be an EU referendum tomorrow, how would members of our panel vote, in or out?
And you're asking just for a simple in and out answer, aren't you? You don't want them to go on and in explanation. Yeah, I thought so. And that's what they're going to do. And I'm not going to even hardly ask Patrick O'Flynn because he'd give the quickest one. Patrick O'Flynn.
Not a difficult choice for me. Out into becoming a global trading nation once again, not shackled to the economic twilight zone that's the Eurozone.
And if your only way out of the stocks, Chris Grayling, was to vote yes or no now, would it be yes or no as things stand, and if they remained as they are now, rather than being subject to negotiated change?
Well, I don't regard the status quo as acceptable, but we're going to win the election, we're going to have a renegotiation, okay. And then the people can decide.
Sarah Tether, yes or no?
I'd be voting to stay in because I think it's good for Britain, it's good for jobs.
Any circumstances in which you would vote no, Sadiq Khan?
I'm sorry?
Any Sadiq Khan, any grounds on which you would say, no, we'll leave?
No, I can't see it because I'm not a small-minded little Englander.
OK, we'll leave it there with a reminder of the Any Answers number because all that we've been discussing, I'm certain, will provoke a great many calls. 03 700 100 444 is the number. Julian Warraker will be there. Our next, please.
Deb Borgan. In light of this week's disturbances at the G4S-run Oakwood Prison and the first ever walkout by barristers over cuts to the legal aid system, is the government right to now be privatising the probation service?
This bill comes into the House, I think I'm right, on Tuesday, early next week.
Well, the bill doesn't privatise the probation service. What the bill does is extend supervision to 45,000 people who will walk out of prison in the next 12 months, who will receive no supervision at all. They'll walk onto the streets with £46 in their pocket, and the majority of them will re-offend. It is a travesty of our justice system. All of those people, if you talk to them, say as they approach their release date, I do not know what's going to happen to me. I don't know where I'm going to go. And to have a situation where those people are going to walk our streets unsupervised and unsupported, very likely to reoffend, is something we have to end. And the whole purpose of our reforms is to do something that the last government wanted to do but could not bring itself to do and decided it could not afford to do, which is to provide mentoring and support to those people in a way that's not been done before to try and tackle what I regard as the biggest hole in our justice system.
And that increase in the service, as you described, will be done by the private sector.
It's going to be, what I'm trying to do is to bring together a mix of private, public and voluntary sector. I want the management skills of the private sector to operate the system in a way that's more efficient and less bureaucratic at the moment. I want the risk management skills of the public sector, the skills in monitoring the most serious, violent and dangerous offenders, and I want the mentoring skills that exist in some of the fine charities that exist in this city and this borough, who I think can bring to bear a dimension to the support provided to people who've been in prison that is not there to anything like the degree it could be at the moment.
Sarah Tether.
I mean, I'm not opposed to the principle of privatisation, and I'm very much in favour of work that we do to try and prevent people from reoffending. I do worry about the monopoly that G4S has over a whole range of different things within our criminal justice system, right from the... I think apart from anything else, it can end up as a profound conflict of interest where, you know, they're ending up providing security when you first come to the police station. They could end up being, if you end up in court, they're providing security there. They may well be providing a legal firm support if you're taken to court. They're then running the prison system. They're then running the system when you leave prison. I mean, it does concern me that G4S in particular don't have a great record. And I think if we're going to go down this route, we need to ensure that there are a variety of different people who can provide that service.
You, Sadiq Khan, stood in opposition to the proposals from the government.
I mean, look, when I'm not in Parliament and not on any questions, Chris and I get on quite well. But Chris is the Justice Secretary with least understanding of our justice system in my lifetime. I mean, the same...
Does it help to get on really well?
The same companies... The National Audit Office and independent bodies have said the way the government privatised our translation services was a disaster and wasted millions of pounds.
We have had dead people being tagged, and we've been invoiced for them by these private companies. The Olympic security was a disaster of all epic scales. We've had prisoners who should be transferred in G4S and Serco vans not turning up or turning up late, but us being invoiced. And we've got Oakwood, where Oakwood Prison is easier, according to Her Majesty's Inspector of Prisons, in that prison, to get drugs than to get soap. So you'll forgive me of when Chris Grayling's bright idea is that the most dangerous offenders who leave our custodial estate should be supervised by these sorts of private companies. If you'll forgive me if I think that's not a very good idea. I think the probation service, who are professionalised, do a very, very difficult job. Often, the people they're supervising have got mental problems. They've never had a job before. They could be a real risk to their ex-partner. And probation officers have to balance the risk to public safety with making sure these people are rehabilitated. At the same time...
And that has to be done by public sector workers, does it?
No, I think if you want to pilot the use of private companies, let's pilot it. Let's see if it's possible to get a partnership between voluntary groups, between the private company and with the probation service, rather than the big bang approach that Chris... No other country in the world uses the private sector to do this.
Sadiq, it's already happening in Peterborough and it's working. No, it is worth saying...
Apple and Pears. I know we set it up. It's Apple and Pears, Chris.
It is worth saying that since I became Justice Secretary, I haven't given contracts to G4S and Serco. When you worked in transport in the last government, you gave five contracts to G4S and Serco.
That wasn't public safety, though, Chris. This is public safety.
The contract on electronic tagging was issued by the Labour Party.
You don't understand it, Chris. We now have evidence that it's not working. And what you should be doing is you should be telling them to shape up or ship them out. And as far as legal aid is concerned, Jonathan...
What do you think I've been doing for the last 6 months?
As a direct consequence of the policies that Chris is talking about...
There is warring factions.
Well, no, Patrick, before you do, there's a real danger with our legal aid changes that people who should be properly prosecuted, found guilty and be sent to prison, won't be done so because they won't be properly...
So right, that's not the question.
Will those who are innocent will not be able to be acquitted.
You can, but just... I absolutely want to hear what you want to say, but let just... Will you commit to what you're going to ask him?
Sadiq, 2 years ago, the Labour Party argued for cuts to criminal legal aid. Will you commit, if you win the general election, to reversing the legal aid cuts?
Well, Chris, I've said we'll make savings to the legal aid budget. We've got to make savings, but I'm not saying what you do is you throw everything out, the bath, the kitchen, the sink, the tables, the chairs, everything. What you need to have
is a
justice system that works. Lawyers, judges, those who work in the system have offered savings.
Because,
because you're trying to get a cheap headline, you've refused to work with them. What you're going to see, Chris, is legal aid lawyers not becoming legal aid lawyers, and it'll be the same old people who can have mummy and daddy supporting them being barristers.
Let me bring in the very patient Patrick O'Flynn, who wants to step between you, he claims.
Thank you. And what I've got to say may surprise people, because often UKIP is portrayed as being to the right of the Conservative Party on everything. And I say we're not. We're in the common sense centre of British politics. And when there are issues, well, listen to what I'm saying. When there are issues such as, I hear Chris use the term private sector management skills, and Sadiq points out the Olympic security farce, which had to be solved by a public sector institution, namely the British Army. And let's not forget the banking crash, which caused such a terrible effect on living standards throughout this country, that private sector management skills had a very major role to play in that as well. And also, when you have the state in charge of people's liberty and you have the Queen's insignia on certain institutions, to me, that means something. And I'm very wary about farming everything out to basically a very few big private sector providers who make enormous profits from taxpayers' money. If Chris is talking about using the charitable sector a bit and innovative ideas and all that, then that's all well and good. But I am suspicious and sceptical of this idea about privatising branches of public service to do with the criminal justice system.
Deb Morgan, you put the question. What is your own view?
Well, I've worked as a probation officer in London for over 27 years, and my view and that of NAPO, National Association of Probation Officers, is that if the bill goes through on Tuesday, it means that 70% of the high-performing probation service will be sold off, and it will lead to a fragmented criminal justice system and will not be able to protect the public as effectively as it currently does.
Quick response on that, Chris Grayling.
Well, I'd be astonished if the view of NAPO, the Probation Officers Union, was otherwise. But fundamentally, this change is about righting a terrible wrong, which is that those 45,000 people, many of them from dysfunctional backgrounds, young people who've not had proper parenting support as they grew up, not had adequate support in early adult life, will walk out of prison onto the streets of this capital and elsewhere with £46 in their pocket and nothing else. And we'll get no
but
support
Chris,
at all. And
Chris, let me come in again. Yes, you can, Deb.
It's actually factually wrong.
Correct.
Thank you. The original impetus for reforming and restructuring the probation service was this high rate of the people sentenced to under 12 months, they're reoffending. Can I please make it clear that the probation service has no statutory responsibility to supervise those people, and we would welcome the opportunity to do so. And to get this bill through on this lie is morally wrong and factually incorrect.
And also, Jonathan.
I'm going to go to Chris Grayling, and then I'll bring you in. Sorry. Chris Grayling.
I'm afraid that's not right. It is certainly the case. It is certainly the case that 45,000 people leave prison every year with £46 in their pocket and nothing else. They receive no current support. The last government looked at whether it could provide that support, and in 2010 said we can't afford to do so. I found a way which I believe will allow us to do that. I think it's really necessary. There are people who will be victims of crime otherwise who will not be because these people are supervised.
But Chris, you make it as if NAPA would say that, wouldn't they? But it's not just NAPA, is it? You've got chief executives and chairs of probation trusts who will warn you about the risk to public safety. You have former Lord Chief Justices. You have former probation inspectors and the current probation inspector. You've got select committees all warning you, please be careful. If you want to try the private sector, as Patrick said, if you want to try charities, you want to try voluntary groups, don't go for the big bang. Work with these skilled probation officers to see if we can have a system that works, saves money, addresses rehabilitation, and keeps the public safe. Why are you in such a rush to get to the next job so quick?
We could continue that, of course. And maybe you will, and I'll give the numbers. We're so early in the year, once again, 03 700 100 444, the email address na.answers@bbc.co.uk. The line's open, incidentally, at 12:30 on Saturday. To our next, and has to be our last.
Veronica Fulton. Alistair Campbell famously said, "We don't do God. Do members of the panel do God?"
Sarah Teller.
Yes.
Can you elaborate?
Isn't that enough?
It would be interesting to hear a little elaboration of your expression of commitment.
Well, I mean, I think it's probably the reason I ended up in politics in the first place. For me, it was always a method of living out the vocation I felt as part of my faith to work on social justice issues.
And that's why you're leaving politics, because you can't do that?
Yeah, it is now, yeah. But I think my core sense of vocation was around social justice, and for a long time, politics was the right vehicle for me for delivering that. So I think in the future, I will need to look for something else, and I don't know what that is yet.
Sadiq Khan.
I mean, the question also, do you do God? I mean, yes, I'm a Muslim, and I believe in God, but I think we've got multiple identities, and there are a number of things that define who we are and that determine the values we have. So I'm a Londoner, I'm a dad, and I'm a husband. My ethnic origin is from Pakistan and India. I'm a working class boy, middle class adult. So my view is you can do God, but that doesn't necessarily need to be the only thing that determines what you say, what you stand for, which political party you may join.
Thank you. And Patrick O'Flynn.
Well, to be fair to Alistair Campbell for a minute, and I suppose one has to, he wasn't saying, I think, that no one with religious convictions could apply those convictions to the political process. He was just warning about pushing a particular religious faith too much front and centre and at the risk of kind of dividing the community. I don't myself have a religious faith, using the word faith, a very strong word. I do come from, sort of roughly speaking, Irish Catholic background in my family. I guess I don't do God, but I do approach politics very much from an ethical point of view anyway. And
do you think religion has a significant part in creating that ethical environment, or could you have that ethical environment without, quotes, doing God?
Well, look, Britain still is a Christian country in the sense of an established church. And that's given us a great ethical framework, no doubt about it whatsoever, that I'm comfortable operating within. I don't actually have a religious faith myself.
Chris Grayling.
Well, the answer to your question is yes, but I think there's a broader issue here that we're a multi-faith country. We draw strength from being a multi-faith country. We find some really important values to be found across the different faith communities. What we must also not forget, though, is that we are also fundamentally and originally a Christian country. And in embracing the faiths that we now have in this country, we should not do so at the expense of the Christian faith, and we should not allow a politically correct doctrine to say, in order to try and embrace other faiths, we somehow have to shove Christianity to one side. And you've got to be very careful.
I'm not...
Just to say, Chris, you'll be pleased that the European Court found that, that the human rights meant that British people wearing the cross could do so thanks to human rights legislation. So there you go. Human rights supports your faith.
I was about to say that we end this programme with philosophy and theology, the purpose of the Heathrop College, but we ended it with philosophy, theology of a kind, plus politics. As you might expect. Next week, we're going to be at the Greenbank High School in Southport with Anna Soubry, the Defence Minister, the Shadow Health Secretary, Andy Burnham, Christine Taken, who's a supermarket ombudswoman, and the businessman, Tony Caldera. Join us there, but from the Heathrop College, goodbye. I hope you enjoyed Any Questions this week. To find out more about the programme or how you can get us to come to your area, then go to the BBC Radio 4 website and search for Any Questions.